Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I'd like to invite you to join me for a pilgrimage tour to France this September. It's based on my book, St. Benedict and St. Therese, The Little Rule and the Little Way. I'll be teaching about the spiritualities and the lives of these two great saints, and we'll be visiting the great monastery of Fleury, where St. Benedict's relics are venerated, and of course going to Lisieux to visit the childhood home of St. Therese, the Carmel where she was a nun, and the great basilica dedicated to her honor. But there's more than that. At Paris, we'll be visiting the Basilica of Sacré-Cœur, Rue de Bac with the Miraculous Medal, going on to Vézelay, Nevers with St. Bernadette, Paray-le-Monial, where the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus was given to St. Margaret Mary, and then Chartres Cathedral, Mont-Saint-Michel, the Normandy beaches, and more. I think there's not only going to be time for instruction and learning, but also prayer and worship, celebrating Mass in the various locations, and also time for fellowship and a good bit of French food and wine, too. Come and join us this September. If you'd like to know more, go to CatholicHeritageTours.com. That's CatholicHeritageTours.com, or be in touch with me through my website, DwightLongenecker.com.
Fellowship and love.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and today with us we have Carrie Gress. She has a doctorate in philosophy from the Catholic University of America. She's the editor at the online magazine Helena Daily, a faculty member at Pontifex University, and a member of the International Marian Association. Dr. Gress is a regular Catholic media contributor and the author of 6 books, including The Marian Option, which we featured here before. Today, we'll be speaking about her latest, The Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity. Welcome to the show, Carrie.
Thank you so much for having me back on, Pete.
You're welcome. So to get started, I guess what I want to ask is, what drew you to writing about feminism, particularly with the subtitle of the book, Toxic Femininity, and all the stuff that's going on that we see today?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. I first really started looking into this when I wrote the book, The Marian Option. Prior to that, when I was a graduate student at Catholic University working on my doctorate, I really didn't have any interest in writing about women. In fact, I kind of swore it off at one point. So it always makes me laugh, and I actually have gotten involved in this as a topic. But when I was writing The Marian Option, I was doing all of this research on who Our Lady is and just seeing that the incredibly influential role that she's played throughout history. Not just, you know, in terms of civilization, but also in terms of women and acting as a role model for them, but also it's really devotion to her that helped develop this idea that women are equal in dignity to men. And so all of these things were kind of swirling in my head, but I was also contrasting that with elite women in our own culture today. And of course, they're really nothing like who Our Lady is, and it's almost laughable to even think about suggesting to a secular audience that they should look to the Virgin Mary for you know, a model of womanhood.
Mm-hmm.
So this just was something that I spent a lot of time thinking about, and I put a short chapter, there's a chapter in the Marian Option about this idea of an anti-Mary. But then, for the last 2 years, I just kept digging into it. I knew that there was a lot more to it, especially looking into Marxism, looking into the occult, and looking just at these trends that we've seen that have been so dramatic in our own culture, at developing this idea of an anti-Mary, not as an individual, but as a spirit that has kind of taken hold of Western civilization really since the 60s. So that's kind of where it all came from.
So you highlight a lot of things in the book. We have promiscuity, eroticism, prostitution, abortion, homosexuality, the list goes on and on. And all of these things have infiltrated our society today. They're the hot button media topics of the day, shall we say. Is there a specific cause that you found in your research or that you can point to in time that where this trend began?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the scary thing, was just what I was able to unearth. there's a woman named Mallory Millett, who is, she's the sister of Kate Millett. And Kate Millett was one of the sort of, we call now the grandmothers of second wave feminism. And Mallory was a big follower of her sister and of the feminist movement until she finally got fed up with it for many reasons. But now she's, Mallory's a Catholic convert and is doing a lot to tell her sister Kate's story. And Kate died about 2 or 3 years ago. And so she's more at liberty to say, you know, exactly what was going on in Kate's life. But she has these amazing stories about, you know, 12 women meeting in an apartment in New York City in late 60s, early 70s. And this was kind of this litany that they chanted. They were trying to destroy the patriarchy. And of course, all of this was influenced by Marxism. But they, but part of that was they realized that in order to destroy the patriarchy and really the family, they needed to implement all of these kinds of things, whether it was, you know, including abortion, that whole list that you just gave, eroticism, homosexuality, on and on. So it's actually part of this litany that they said that these were their goals that they wanted to achieve. Now, whether or not they had any sense at how effective they would be, you know, back in the day, it's pretty overwhelming to look at that list now and see that they've achieved everything. So you have these 12 women who basically through the means of media, but also through the establishment of women's studies programs in universities, they've been incredibly successful and achieved all of these goals that they set out to achieve, you know, in that apartment, just 12 of them so many years ago. But there was this awful blend, of course, of Marxism, lesbianism, the occult, all kinds of things that were just, you know, bound together in this deadly cocktail, really, of ideology that we are now still suffering the fruit. Fruit's probably not the right word, but the destruction of. But yeah, it started with those 12 women.
It's interesting. You state in the book that these examples are all evidence of an anti-Marian movement. And really, we haven't seen anything in our time or in our lives that has invaded society so deeply as these have we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think, you know, there's just historically, there's nothing that has been like this ever in history where you actually have women who are so willing to kill their own children. I think that's one of the things that I keep coming back to and I've marveled about over and over again. How is it that they were able to convince so many everyday, seemingly normal women that somehow killing their own child would be a solution to their problems? And the fact that that most fundamental relationships has now become so broken and something that is clearly so denigrated is just... it's really horrifying to see how effective they have been through marketing and through the spreading of these ideas to convince us that this is actually a good thing when, you know, historically, of course, abortions happen, but tragically, I mean, it was not something that people shouted or were excited about or even thought was just this primary element that women needed to survive. And now we're told, you know, the real lie that they sell to us over and over again is that our children are our enemy, that if you have children, it's going to destroy your career, it's going to destroy your life. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's an incredible lie, especially to those of us who have children and to see the amazing things that happen. I can tell you there are plenty of things that I can do that because I became a mother that I couldn't have done beforehand because of this personality traits and the virtues that you develop as a mom. But in any event, I think that is, it comes back to that fundamental lie that our children are our enemy. And of course, part and parcel of that is also just the lie that our husbands and that men are really the enemy too. Mm-hmm. You can see how it fractures the whole family because there's no way a family can stay together when you have the mother who's really the soil of the culture, you know, at odds both with her children and her husband.
Yeah, it seems kind of evident to me, at least in my experience, that the side that's pushing that agenda has a great PR machine, and we don't have quite as good of a PR machine. what's interesting, what's interesting is, you know, here locally there's been a lot of talk about colleges and the need for students to be going into trades rather than other areas. Right. And it seems like when they go into college to get to those, that's where the indoctrination occurs.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right about that. And that's part of the effort by Kate Millett to get these women's studies programs there. And I think we can also overemphasize just how connected this is to socialism and to Marxism. I mean, it shouldn't surprise any of us that these are the two hot button issues in the culture right now being promoted, whether it's, you know, this idea of infanticide and what we're seeing with abortion, and also connecting that with this, you know, the Green New Deal and Marxism. These things go hand in hand. They're not separate ideas. And at the root of them is, of course, that we can change the idea of human nature, that human nature is changeable. We don't really need families. We can just kind of recreate men in our own, the image that we want to see them created into, which, of course, is you know, pure Marx, this idea that we can become almost robots. You know, that's the Russian word for robots, or robotnik, is workers. That can be really the primary goal of our existence. And you see that within feminism and this idea that I call the matriarchy, this elite group of women that pretty much control everything. They control the PR in Hollywood. They control it in the fashion industry, the book industry, pop music, politics, all of it. And all of it is really bound tightly together again by this idea of abortion. That's, you know, one of the reasons why it's so hard for us to sort of make inroads in our arguments, even though we have much better arguments. And I think the science proves our arguments. It's hard to make those when you can't really even get the airtime, you know, on the nightly news.
Mm-hmm. You included a quote in a book from St. Irenaeus that I like to get your thoughts on. And for me, it explains a lot about the importance of Mary. And that quote is, "The enemy would not have been just conquered unless it had been a man made of a woman who conquered him."
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that was a profound insight, I think, by Irenaeus that I found. I think so often we are quick to think that Mary is not important, that she's kind of superfluous. And we see this certainly among Protestants, you know, seeing that, you know, we don't need Mary. She's great for a nativity scene, but otherwise we don't really need to engage with her at all. And I think that Irenaeus just points to the fact of how important it was. And we see this again, this idea of this, the Adam and Eve were first, Christ and Mary are the new Adam and the new Eve. And, you know, we see that Eve was the one that handed off the fruit to Adam. So it makes sense for Our Lady, and she's called repeatedly, you know, she's the one that came along and reversed the curse of Eve. So there's a lot of different ways and angles that we can look at that quote, but I think it's an effective one to see really how important and vital her role is in our own salvation. And it's not something just coincidental or, you know, incidental, but an important piece of understanding who we are as Christians and Catholics, and certainly understanding who we are as women. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's been so easy for women to go off the rails, because we don't have a model of femininity or womanhood to be really following. Instead, especially under Protestantism, men were made sort of the pinnacle of the faith experience of, you know, a pastor and whatnot. But all of the religious orders, the female religious orders, were abandoned. Our Lady was abandoned. And so what do you have left? You just have women, you know, any kind of aspiration they have to thinking of their own salvation and whatnot has to come through a man, instead of actually seeing that, no, there really is this feminine way of doing that. And I think that's one of the great things that the church has to offer, is this very uniquely feminine way of approaching God, this really intimate relationship that God calls all women to, but that few of us know about because we don't have these examples or role models or, you know, the great saints to remind us of them. So I think that's another crucial piece, is just recognizing that we have all of these elements that really can speak to the fulfillment of the human heart, but we haven't done a great job of promoting them or getting them out there to women at large. And instead, we've just kind of been, you know, the feminist movement has sort of steamrolled our own message. And so that's really, we've got to work cut out for us to get that message out, that the church truly is the place where women can find happiness. Mm-hmm. That was even reiterated again this week. There was, or last week rather, I think there was a piece in the New York Times by Brad Wilcox that was talking about this new study showing that the happiest women on the planet are married, traditional, conservative women. So there's a lot to be said for what we have to offer women, and we haven't been saying it enough.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break, but there's plenty more to cover. We'll be back with Carrie Gress to discuss more of her book, The Anti-Mary Exposed. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. We'll be right back.
Do you wish you knew the saints better? Overwhelmed with all the events in Catholic history and just wish you could tie it all together? It's tough work, and even scientists have determined that it takes approximately 400 repetitions to create a new synapse in the brain, unless it is done with play, in which case it takes between 10 and 20 repetitions. Introducing Saint Cards, where the facts about saints and history are presented in fun and engaging games for ages 4 to 104. Check out Saint Cards at saintcards.com and begin the fun for your family, school, and parish today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We're spending the day with Carrie Gress and discussing your book, The Anti-Mary Exposed. And Carrie, in this book, and we touched upon it in the last segment, but just to get a little deeper, you write about how women are a Marian icon and that society has been gradually erasing that away. Can you detail that comment a bit more for us?
Yeah, no, I think, there's a lot there in this idea of how it is that women are meant to be a representation of who Our Lady is. That's kind of this, she's an icon for us that we are meant to follow. But in when we follow her, that becomes a way in which, especially our husbands, our sons, other men around us, have brothers, they all have the capacity to then start understanding who Our Lady is through us. And you can see what happens when you really destroy a woman through vice, that she then doesn't have that capacity to model Our Lady. She doesn't have the capacity to actually help people understand what heaven is. And all women are called to be bridges, to be help bridge people to heaven. But we also have the capacity to bridge people to hell. And I think we are seeing that pretty readily in our own culture, where women are quite literally leading others to hell because of their own vice and just adding to it, and, you know, the cyclical nature of sin that we're seeing a lot of. But yeah, I think there's also a lot to be said just even thinking about how women are this soil of civilization. There's some great quotes in the book, one by Fulton Sheen and another one by, I talk about a priest who wanted to work on vocations, how do we increase vocations? And rather than starting with young men, he started with their moms. And then went to their dads, and then finally went to the young men and young women to try to find vocations, because he knew that you had to start with the soil. He'd grown up as a farmer, and he said, if you've got bad soil, you're not going to get good fruit. And so that's why he really thought it was important to start with the mothers. And this is where that Fulton Sheen quote is so great. And mm-hmm. he says that real measure of civilization is with women. So I think there's a lot that we don't really even consider as women. We're, again, we have this kind of one type of message that's getting out to us. And that message is really over and over again that we're victims. And so we need to sort of start rethinking this, and we look at the bigger picture of what does it mean to be a woman, and what is it that we provide to our families and to civilization? And where is our real, where are our real gifts? Instead of always feeling like we have to, you know, fight the man or become the man or whatever else, we have to start looking again at what we've been gifted with and how it is that we can really change culture through changing ourselves, instead of feeling like we have to, go out with anger and rage and self-absorbed ambition to conquer the world outside of us.
One of the areas you look at in the book is you look at envy and its roles in radical mm-hmm. feminism, and you compare it to how things play out in fairy tales. Can you mm-hmm. share what you outlined there with us a bit?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the fun things and shock, really striking things, actually, that I discovered researching this book, was just looking into the role of envy. And I don't think we talk enough as Catholics about how big envy is in the lives of women. And I part of it is because I don't think men experience it to the extent that women do. It's something that's kind of naturally born into us. And there's a sociologist that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book, Joyce Bennisford. She's written this book called Warriors and Warriors. Her basic point, and she's not Catholic, the book is published, you know, through Oxford University Press. But she talks a lot about how women are just have this ingrained sense of both trying to get things for themselves, but also things for their children. And part of that has to do with the fact that we are physically weaker, but also because of the weakness that happens when we have children. We have this dependent person, and it's a long period of time that we have to sort of see that person through to maturity. So Bennisford makes it really clear that because of that, we have kind of this natural instinct to be grasping for things for ourselves or for our children or for our family members. And that it shows up very, very early. And, you know, if you talk to any grade school principal, they will tell you that one of their biggest issues is dealing with all the infighting among girls. And it's just that kind of, there's something very natural about it, but it's not ordered. And the ordering of that has to come, obviously, through the virtue. And we have women have the capacity to be incredibly virtuous and selfless and giving. But again, that's not something that comes naturally to most of us. So unfortunately, a lot of us really struggle with this, and we think we're the only ones that struggle with it. So I actually enjoyed reading this book because it was such a consolation that, you know, no, it's not just me or the women that I struggle with in my own life or have struggled with in my own life or other women that I know that are going through these problems. But in fact, this is kind of a ubiquitous experience of womanhood. And I think that's something that is important for all women to understand, that that's just kind of part of who we are. In fact, I love, there was an interview done with who's the actress? She was in, now she's a nun. She's the mother. Her name is completely just escaping me right now. I know you know who I'm talking about. She was in movies like Rock Hudson and whatnot. Anyway, she has this great story about how she went to the Academy Awards, I think. And even like at 80 years old, she was still concerned about her appearance and how she looked and whatnot. And so I thought it was just such a great, admission of just what it means to be a woman and how to get through those things. And of course she had great response to how do we, deal with that. But it was just this recognition that even at 80 years old, you're still going to be struggling with that. So anyway, I think that's one of the things that we've done a poor job of really helping women through and with throughout their lives. But this is again where we see fairy tales. I mean, fairy tales is really a story of envy. You've got the older woman who's kind of, she's in charge. She's either a witch or she's an old queen or something. And here comes this upstart who threatens her empire. And so sure enough, it's all about her trying to destroy the upstart. You know, let's put her to sleep for 100 years or let's wipe her out or, you know, whatever the story may be. But what's fascinating is to sort of look at that model of fairy tales and how do we see that play out in our own culture? Well, it's not really the upstart younger women that women are going after in our own culture. It's actually men. Women have this really bizarre relationship with men that has developed again out of this 1960s, 70s culture where they're saying we want to be just like men, we can compete with men, but at the same time, men have to change and become more like us. So it's this really odd dynamic. And that's really, of course, where the notion of toxic masculinity came from. And of course, that's just a play on my in the title of my book of toxic femininity, because we're not really looking at really where the source of the problem is. We're pinning it on toxic masculinity, but in fact, it's really I think emanating much more from toxic femininity than anything else at this point.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because that's one catchphrase recently that really pushes my buttons for obvious reasons. It's toxic masculinity. And, you know, I'll be 45 this year. All this catchphrase of stuff seems to me, and I haven't been living in a box for the last 10 years, but for the last 5 years is when this all seemed to explode. Didn't even talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Where did this toxic masculinity garbage come from?
Right. Well, it was kind of baked into the cake. I mean, this came back, is all back to the 1960s and this desire for men to change. I think they just kind of stumbled upon a catchphrase that actually started getting some traction for them. But really the idea is, again, and Gloria Steinem has written about this. I mean, 85 years old or something now. And she had a book come out a couple of years ago that she was busy promoting. And while she was promoting it, she was talking about how she really sees herself as a genderless person. And that's really the goal, is for men to sort of become more like women and women to become more like men. And that, our sexuality and all of those things are just sort of no longer important and just very fluid. And, we all kind of resemble each other. So this idea of complementarity is completely washed off the table. And so it's just another way, I think it's another way for women to actually control men. And, the feminist movement has been trying to do this for a long time, either by bullying men or convincing them that they're wrong or they're disordered or they shouldn't have an opinion about things. And I think toxic masculinity is just a kind of another concept that they've thrown onto the fire that seems to be getting some traction for them. Definitely. And of course, all of this exploded with the Me Too movement, simultaneously. So it's kind of an ugly mix. But and that's really where actually the idea for adding toxic femininity to the title actually came from Mallory Millett, who, Kate Millett's sister. And 50 years ago, almost to the month, Mallory Millett helped her sister Kate come up with a title for her book, which was called Sexual Politics. And for that book, she was on the cover of Time magazine, and she was really lauded as the priestess of the feminist movement. So it was an incredible thing when Mallory came to me with that word, and I was like, yes, we have to work that in the title. Mm-hmm. For her to have that experience of coming full circle and really coming up with a title for a book that was, the exact opposite of what her sister had been promoting 50 years ago.
So what is the relationship between radical feminism and goddess worship? You discuss this in the book, and for those mm-hmm. unfamiliar, perhaps maybe right. we should start with what is goddess worship?
Yeah. And that's a really good question. There is this other movement that has developed where basically that the goddesses from ancient history and women like Diana and all kinds of goddesses from back in the day have been resurrected, so to speak, and brought out as women to emulate. But unfortunately, it's just another form of paganism. And anytime the church is weak, anytime Judaism is weak, paganism is going to creep back into the culture. And so this is another example of that. But it was really sort of something that was cobbled together back in the 70s. There were certainly a number of books that were written that I list in my book. And just the idea being that all women have sort of this goddess inside of them, and we have to get in touch with this goddess. And then this goddess will help us, lead us to wisdom and to world peace and all kinds of other nonsense. And actually, it was funny. I just watched the pilot episode of Wonder Woman from back in the day, and my daughters wanted to watch it. And I think it's on Amazon or something, and we watched it. And I was just cracking up, first of all, because it's hysterical, because it's so dated. But it's tragic because of the whole idea, in Wonder Woman is based on this idea of kind of going back to the goddess and the woman being perfect and having being the perfect human and having these capacities to usher in world peace, and that everything is messed up by men and whatnot. So it starts out sort of as something benign, benign paganism, but it's really translated more deeply into the occult and Wicca and calling on different demons. Lilith is one that I talk about a great deal. Lilith is a demon that goes back to even before our own scriptures. She's mentioned in scriptures, but she's basically what she does is she seduces men and kills babies. And even the word lullaby comes from the Arabic, which means to protect against Lilith. So this is this old mythology that's been running for millennia. And yet here she is, comes out again. And now you've got women who are part of this goddess worship holding her up as this woman that really, gives it to the patriarchy, and that, is worth naming books after and characters after. There was the Lilith Fair a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Sarah McLachlan put it together, music festival with all kinds of female artists. You had the Lilith Fund that was set up after Hurricane Harvey blew through Houston, where, money was donated so that women could get abortions after the hurricane. It's fascinating to see how these very old goddesses and even demons. I actually approached a couple of exorcists about this. you know, all this is coming sort of full circle, and we're seeing a real connection between this goddess worship movement and feminism, that they both go together. And part and parcel of that is, of course, just this idea that they believe that woman is the pinnacle of creation. And so even something like lesbianism becomes very vital to their beliefs, because that relationship apparently is supposed to be the highest ideal, given the fact that you are dealing with these women that have goddesses within them. So anyway, a lot of it is incredibly irrational and illogical, but somehow people have really glommed onto it. So yeah, it's a really tragic connection that I think we, and you know, it's another one of those areas where we haven't been paying enough attention to it to sort of see how dangerous it is.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break. We'll be back to wrap up our discussion of the Anti-Mary Exposed. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media.
I have a quiz for you. What is one of the greatest gifts parents can give to their children? It's something children ask for often. When this gift is received, the entire family is incredibly joyful and transformed on the special occasion of the arrival of this masterpiece. This gift calls for faith, courage, and generosity on the part of the givers. It lasts for many decades, only getting better, changing, and developing each day. This magnificent gift is unique and can never be repeated, but a similar gift can be added approximately every year. This gift can only be given by three persons agreeing and acting. Have you guessed it yet? Yes, this profound gift is that of welcoming another child. And the three persons agreeing are husband, wife, and God. I'm Jim Littleton, forming FaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We've been spending the day with Carrie Gress, and we're talking about her book, The Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity. And let's ask a big question here. We've covered a lot of ground, but as we wind down in this last segment, you propose that Mary is the antidote to this chaos in our society today and its downward spiral. How so?
Well, for many reasons, I think she is the answer. I mean, the first one, of course, is just the fact that for how many centuries she really was this model of Christian womanhood, and she really provides us with a way to understand how it is that we can draw closer to Christ, how we can become holier, how we can do God's will, all of those things. But I think the one thing that I really struggled with in describing, you know, the second half of the book is all really devoted to Our Lady and trying to understand who she is, was really trying to get beyond her as this very superficial person. I think so often it's very easy to think of her as just very saccharine or kind of a statue in the side of the church. She doesn't really have a connection to our own lives in the world today. And I know that was something that was my own struggle growing up. And part of that, again, is because of the fact that we've been told that women need to act like X. You know, we need to be ambitious. We need to, you know, get angry about things and outspoken and, you know, all this kind of exertion of energy. And I know in my own case, it was actually out of my comfort zone, but I didn't know any better. And so it was just one of those things that I just felt like I had to be. And then when I finally discovered that I didn't have to be like that, it was just so incredibly freeing. And that's not to say that there aren't women that feel that way naturally. I mean, obviously we all have different temperaments. But at the same time, I think there's certain elements that a lot of us that come to us very naturally, and we have to almost override, to feel like we are, you know, have a place at the table in the culture today. So that's one of the sad things. And one of the hard things about talking about Our Lady is that we just don't understand her from the inside. We don't understand even what means to be meek. I mean, we think of her in sort of terms of she's a real doormat. And in fact, she's anything but a doormat, but that's hard for us to understand. So I wanted to actually, in the book, I look at three different elements of the desires of women's hearts and just say, you know, Mary has these in spades, and we can kind of go to her through these different desires that we have. And of course, one of them, the biggest desire that I think we also don't talk enough about is this desire to be known and loved. And that's really where she's an incredible model, because of the fact that she had this amazing relationship, mind-blowing relationship, really, with God the Father in such a way that she knew always that she was loved deeply and, you know, profoundly. And I think that that is one of the pieces that we're so missing in the culture, that we don't realize how much God the Father loves us, adores us, and wants to shower us with good graces and gifts. So I think that's one of the big struggles. But I think that's where she can become a model, is to sort of look at her relationship with God the Father and how that flourishes. And of course, you know, naysayers can say, well, yeah, she was perfect, so it was easy for them to have that relationship. Mm-hmm. But that's the beauty of it, is that she is there, A, to help us become more like her, but also to just create, help grow that relationship such that we know that it's there. God already knows of the relationship and knows how much he loves us and adores us and dotes on us. We need to, it's us that need to look back and recognize that that relationship exists. So that's one thing. The second thing that I think is fascinating about Our Lady is just her goodness and why it is that she was so good. Yes, she was sinless, but her goodness really came from the fact that she was doing God's will. And, you know, we look at all of these feminists, and so many of them think that they were doing good work. They, you know, they were doing all kinds of picketing and taking women to abortion clinics and illegally, and, you know, all kinds of things that they actually thought they were doing good. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, this is a real problem for any of us, is that if we're not doing good that's in accord with God's will, even if we are doing something that is objectively good, not like what they were doing, it can still be a bad thing because it's not God's will. So I think that's another piece, is just understanding that this desire that women have to do good is from God and is a gift, and Our Lady can help us with that. And here again, we also see, you know, the concern about being doormats. But if you look at even women today who are incredibly efficient and effective at what they do, they're still not producing the kind of fruit like someone like St. Catherine of Siena, or St. Helen, or, you know, St. Monica, St. Lucy, all these incredible women. That, why were they effective? They were effective because they understood this notion that when you're connected with God's will, he can act through you and change the culture. So again, it's that idea of our weakness, understanding how our weakness is meant to work and be balanced by God. And then, of course, the last thing is just Our Lady's beauty, understanding her beauty. And this is something that, you know, the multi-billion-dollar beauty industry makes it really clear to us that this is a desire of women as well. And yet, if you look at all the apparitions of Mary to a one, all the people that have seen her said, you know, she was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And even St. Bernadette said, she's so beautiful, you would want to die just so you could see her again. So her beauty is not accidental to her. It's really, again, one of those things where she is radiating God's beauty to us on a human level. And that's, again, what all of us are called to. We just haven't quite figured that out yet, because, again, the messaging that we're getting is not promoting that. It's promoting usually vanity and or sensuality. And it's not promoting this idea of a beauty that lifts up people's hearts, that wants them to find God, that wants to help them, you know, find their eternal home in God the Father. So I think looking at those kinds of three things, I try to sort of look at Mary from a different perspective and look at different virtues of hers, and kind of give a different impression of who she is versus just something very superficial or saccharine that we think of her today in the world today.
Right. Also in the book, you outline six ways to combat this anti-Marian movement, or the people who say good's evil and evil's good. Just to touch on a few of those that we have time for today. To me, the one that you had is the first one, become a spiritual adult. And it's alarming the number of youth today entering adulthood who are totally unprepared in facets of adulthood, including their spiritual life, which then sets them up for that indoctrination we talked about earlier. How do we fix that?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a great question. How do we fix that? Because I think we've been trying to fix it with a lot of things, but we're not really paying attention to how, especially women, how women absorb content. And this has become one of the things I feel like I'm saying all the time now, is just recognizing women absorb content through basically through the influence of other women, whether it's online magazines or it's even regular magazines. And there's not a single magazine at the checkout stand, with the exception of maybe Joanna Gaines' new magazine, that doesn't thoroughly offend, have something offensive about it to every Catholic woman, because they control all the the matriarchy, as I've called them, they control all the media. But we've let them. We haven't said, well, why don't we buy one of them and revamp it so that it has a pro-life message or a Catholic message. We also haven't done things that are similar to it in terms of just the attractiveness of it. And this is a, you know, incredible thing. We have this church that's 2,000 years old. It is, has been the greatest patron of the arts in all of history, and we can't come up with a single beautiful magazine for women to appreciate and absorb the values that are intrinsic to our religion and our relationship with the Trinity. So I think this is something that we haven't done a good job at all of, is just trying to figure out how do we reach women who are not coming in through the doors of the church. And, you know, we spent, I think, the last 20 or so years really building up these institutes, and we have an incredible amount of laity and, of course, great priests and religious. You know, we're seeing a boom within the church. We haven't found this way to sort of break out of that and start helping people get the message, you know, beyond the pews. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really where the next stage that we need to start working on. And of course, you know, a movie like Unplanned is really, you know, iconic in many ways because, of course, it was an incredible movie with an incredible message. But how much censorship did it get at the same time? So you can see both the effort to get the message out and then the pushback coming at it. And I think that's where we need to be, is in that place where we're pushing the message out, even though there's going to be pushback. We need to start doing that and just recognizing how information is absorbed by regular people, because it's gotten to the point where there truly is no alternative for young women to find a different way to live. I mean, they have to have, either it's got to come from somebody that they know, whether it's a mom or a grandmother or a neighbor or a good friend, who has the capacity to show them something different, but they're not going to get it anywhere in the culture. And I think that's something that is really tragic, that you know, we've definitely dropped the ball on in terms of just offering an alternative to what's out there. And you know, some of it I can see people thinking, oh, this is really fluffy stuff, this is really superfluous. Well, it's actually not. There's, you know, I can say as a woman that there's something wonderful about leafing through a magazine. I mean, this is why they've been able to have this staying power. Everything else is gone online, and yet their magazines are still out there. Mm-hmm. Because there's something almost a retreat like. So anyway, I think that's one of the things that we need to start doing is thinking more creatively about how to reach people that aren't even coming into the church itself.
Right. Another area you discuss as far as these six ways to combat the anti-Mary movement is to go deeper into motherhood and spiritual motherhood. So a twofold question, mm-hmm. What can women do to attain this, and what can men mm-hmm. do to help them?
Yeah, I think those are great questions. The first thing that I think is challenging is just the fact that we don't necessarily talk enough about spiritual motherhood. I know that it was something that really wasn't on my radar before I got married and started digging into this. And I think a lot of women feel very left out of the motherhood conversation, either if they're single or they haven't had children, or maybe their children have left home. It's just this sense of, well, what do we do now? And this conversation isn't for us because we're still talking about motherhood. But I think it's more fundamental than that. It's just the recognition of our capacities as women to mother others, to give of ourselves to help improve their lives. And that is a really important thing, especially, you know, you can see aunts, grandmothers, and others doing that. You know, foster care is an incredible opportunity, too, to help transform the lives of others, even just praying for others. If you, you know, there's a woman I know, she lives in Italy and she's single, and she had done some work at an orphanage in Guatemala. And I said, well, we'll just keep those children in your prayers, even though you're not with them. She's like, yeah, I have great pictures of them. I could pray for them regularly. So it doesn't even have to be something that we can do on a physical basis, but it's a matter of really embracing that. And you know, I think Alice von Hildebrand talks about this really well. She's got some beautiful articles on spiritual motherhood because, of course, she herself never had children. She speaks to it, but that's an important element. And I think as far as men being able to support us, you know, the biggest thing that men need to do is truly, and I have great sympathy for men in this book. I didn't want to attack men. I feel like you guys have been attacked enough all sides. So, you know, it's great sympathy. But I think the reality is you guys have a voice and a place at the table, and that's what they've been trying to silence. They don't want to hear you. And we see this way back in the garden, you know, the women want something, the woman wants something, and Adam just says nothing. So that's actually the worst thing that you do is do nothing, is just to, you know, slough that off and just say, this is not my problem. But to really understand that. And I think also it's important for men to understand how attacked women have been and how misguided we have been, because I know there's a lot of resentment towards women in the culture today, especially within the church. And it's a lot of it is because men don't realize we just didn't have any other way. We weren't taught any other way to think. Mm-hmm. And so I think that either both sympathy as well as prayer for women is, you know, an incredible place to start. In addition, just speaking up whenever you can within your own families and communities is really vital.
Well, thanks for that advice. Where can people find your book, The Anti-Mary Exposed: Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity?
They can get it from tanbooks.com or certainly Amazon. And anywhere else, you know, Catholic books are sold.
And it is one I do highly recommend, especially with the current state of culture around us today. Carrie, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us. Any closing thoughts?
Oh, gracious. No, I just thanks so much for having me on and for giving me an opportunity to share this message, because I, like you said, I think it's incredibly vital, and it's something that I think is opening a lot of eyes. A lot of eyes are opening because of this book, and it's been really exciting to see the transformation. I just even heard a story about a lesbian who has left that lifestyle because of this book. So really, really heartening and humbling. Wow.
And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.
Hello, this is International Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.